You are now tuned in to Talks at Midnight, a podcast that dives into haunted histories and chilling murder mysteries. I'm your host, Janet Heredia, and thank you for joining me on today's episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to Talks at Midnight. I am your host, your friend, and your storyteller, Janet Heredia, and tonight, let me just say that we have a doozy of an episode. Now, if you're not a fan of true crime and unsettling stories, then maybe this is not the podcast for you. But if you are, then stay tuned because today we have a very interesting episode. And I say interesting because I swore that I would not talk about this guy. And I said that because it's everywhere. If you have not heard of Wade Steven Wilson, then you are not on the internet. Guys, I swore I wasn't going to talk about him. He's all over the place. He's gone viral. You cannot go online without seeing his face somewhere. And so that is the main reason I said I wasn't going to do anything on him or talk about him or anything. But at this point, I think I have dug deep into this rabbit hole. Yes, I am part of the Kiosk Club with Jumpsuit Pablo and the crew. And you know what? It wouldn't be me if I didn't cover it, right? So anyways, we're going to talk about it today. I have my thoughts and I did my own research and I've heard a lot. I've heard the phone calls. I've heard the phone calls on the Patreon. And if you know what I'm talking about. And I just recovered from that. So, you know, there's that we'll discuss, but I will get into the details of the crime and hopefully in an upcoming episode, I'm thinking this might become a series now. I can have a psychologist on here to talk about a question or talk about a subject that I haven't seen anybody talk about. And it's just been weighing on my noggin for some time. And that is the psychology behind the women, the Wade wives, the Wade widows, and their infatuation with him, even though they know that this guy is who he is. And so I do want to get into that, but I definitely want to talk about a little history on Wade. We want to get into that. We want to get into, who he is or was and how he got to where he is today on death row. So jumping right in, what we can gather is that Wade Wilson's characteristics are that he is 6.5 feet tall, pretty good looking with a built frame, fully tattooed. Even though after his arrest in 2019, he tattooed stitches on his face and a bunch of swastikas. So there's that. But, you know, tattoos are a thing, right? I'm tatted myself, if you know me. I have a sleeve. I have tattoos on my back, on my legs. I'm pretty much tatted everywhere. And so is my husband. So I can understand how that can be somewhat attractive to women or men, for that matter. You know, I know I certainly am. And of course, a tall man can be very sought after as well. So for those reasons, I could totally understand. I mean, say the man was arrested for something like a robbery or something much less offensive, then okay, sure. But murdering two women in cold blood, I mean, how can anyone find themselves wanting to get close to that, you know? I mean, like, if you get with the guy, you got to watch your back. Like, you know, you might get killed or strangled or raped. Jeez. Like some women, I swear. But anyways, we're going to start at the beginning because you can't ever truly grasp the story of someone without knowing their roots, right? So let's start at the beginning. Wade was born May 20th, 1994. Gosh, I was born in 83. When I see dates like this, I'm just like, oh my God, is he even an adult yet? His father, Steve, has spoken and described what life was like for him when Wade was born. He recently went on the Lockdown 23andOne podcast in August and opened up about what was going on for him when his then-girlfriend was pregnant with Wade. Steve stated that his own home life was not ideal. As the child of divorced parents, he said the only person he really had was his girlfriend. And this is Wade's biological mother. Stephen revealed that he was 15 years old when his girlfriend was 14. Although his mother was excited about the pregnancy, she was also suffering from lung cancer, so she never got a chance to meet Wade, especially since she died a month before he was born. Steve's mother had given power of attorney to an older cousin of his who had recently graduated college, and that's who was legally responsible for Stephen. He spent a lot of time with his with Wade's mother, and things took a turn a few months after his son's birth because Steve ended up getting arrested and did an 8-month stint in a juvenile program, which took a toll on his girlfriend, Wade's mother. 6 months into Steve's sentence, Steve receives legal papers that stated that Wade's mother was giving him up for adoption. Steve said in the interview that he was just a kid and that he didn't really have anybody to look out for him or watch his back. He said that he wanted to fight the adoption, but knew he could not do anything about it. As he matured, he says he 100% understood that what they did, putting him up for adoption, was actually the right thing to do. Wade's adoption was handled privately. The parents of his biological mother knew a couple from their church who were looking to adopt a baby boy, and it just worked out where they adopted him and gave him a good life. He said that they're good people and that he didn't know much more beyond that. Now, Wade's criminal history prior to his major conviction included a string of arrests in Leon County, Florida, dating back to 2012, with charges encompassing burglary, grand theft, firearm offenses, and sexual assault. He did serve prison sentences for burglary and grand theft, as well as for firearms theft, and was also acquitted of a sexual battery and kidnapping charge in Tallahassee in 2015. Before his most recent crimes, he was reportedly involved in a violent altercation with his former girlfriend, Mila Montanez, with allegations of assault and strangulation, although charges were not pursued by Mila, and so he was never charged. On October 6th, and now we're getting to the crime, on October 6th of 2019, Wade and his girlfriend, Mila Montanez, went out to a local bar in Fort Myers called the Buddha Lounge Live. They met a few people. Jason Shepard was among them and two women, Christine Melton and Stephanie Sailors. So they partied there till the bar closed down, and then Jason invited them to go over and continue to party. Now, I don't know how it is in your neck of the woods, but in Florida, we love an after-hour party. And so when clubs close down up north, you typically around 2 a.m., a lot of times you end up in house parties or in someone's house hanging out until the daytime, pretty much. This is something that I did quite often when I was, you know, in my early 20s, probably later teen years. Obviously not now. I'm married with kids and, you know, got a house and all the responsibilities in the world. But back in the day, your girl hung out, okay? So they did that. And so Wade tells Mila, you know, he's like, hey, let's go party. But Mila says no, she doesn't want to go, she refuses. And so Wade, he had her keys, which, by the way, Wade was one of these people, right? He had no cell phone, he had no money, he had no car, he couldn't even drive a car because he had a suspended license, or he has a suspended license. And so he was pretty much like, you know, a moocher, if you will. Like, he would get with these girls and they basically had to do everything for him. I even heard an interview with Mila, bless her heart, where she did say that he used to wine and dine her and all of the stuff. And then I don't remember, I'm pretty sure it was Duty Ron who asked her the question, like, so he wined and dined you. How did he do that if he didn't have a job and he was such a loser or whatnot? And then Mila tells him, oh, no, he wined and dined me with my money. So this is the type of guy that we're talking about here. So just so you can keep that in the back of your head. Anyways, Wade tells her that he's going to go outside to the car to grab something. And instead, he took off with someone else driving the car because the car that Mila owns is a Hellcat stick shift, and Wade can't drive stick shift. So I'm assuming that the person that he took off with in her car was Jason, the guy that they were hanging out with, that they were going to his house. That's who I'm assuming it is. I don't think I've heard confirmation of that. But what I did hear was that Mila said that it almost looked like the car was full of people. So I'm speculating that among the people driving was Jason, and then Christine Melton and Stephanie Sailors, her best friend, were probably the people that were in the back seat. I'm almost sure. But anyways, Mila must have realized that it was already like, okay, where's he at? He should have been back from the car already. So when she went outside just in time to see her car drive off of the lot. According to Mila, she was pacing around the parking lot, and one of her friends, who I think, if I'm not mistaken, was already at the Buddha hanging out herself, saw her pacing the parking lot, asked her what was going on. Mila tells her, and to which her friend, I think her friend's name is Amy, tells her, okay, just jump in the car and just come to my house and stay over, and then we'll figure it out in the morning. Obviously, Mila couldn't go home because she didn't have her house keys or her car keys. And also, Mila owns a spa called Mila's Spa in Fort Myers, I believe. And so her business keys were also in her key ring. So basically, she can't get in anywhere. So anyways, she takes off to Amy's house and she ends up spending the night there. Meanwhile, back at Jason's place, the four partied, did drugs, got fucked up. Cocaine was in the vicinity, and it was a party. It was a party. When Stephanie Sailors, who's the girl, like I mentioned, that was with Christine Melton, when she testified, she said at Wade's trial that he and Christine Melton actually were engaging in sex in the other room. So later that night, nearing the early morning, Wade, Stephanie, and Christine decided to leave Jason's house and head on over to Christine's place. Stephanie tells Christine when they get there that she's leaving since she was due to be at work that following day, and stated that everything was fine when she left. Christine hugged her and said that she'll see her tomorrow. According to Wade, later on in his testimony or in his confessions, both he and Christine had sex a few more times, and then Christine fell asleep. He then stated that he took a look over at her asleep and then just jumped on her and choked her out, and I quote. Then he stole her phone and her car and left her there. Honestly. Wade then went to where Mila was at, driving the black Nissan Versa that belonged to Christine. Sometime during the night, remember, he drove off in Mila's Hellcat. So sometime throughout the night, the Hellcat ran out of gas and he left the car somewhere. So at this point, he's driving the Nissan Versa. And he shows up where Mila's at. I guess they got on the phone. She told him to meet me at the spa, and they met up at the spa. So anyways, he gets there, and at this point, Mila sees him pull up in the Versa and realizes that her car is missing, and then she begins to ask Wade, where the fuck is my car? At which point, he demands that she get into his car right now. She was like, no, I'm not getting in the car with you. So an altercation began, and before I get into that, she did mention in the interview that when she saw Wade, he had, like, you know, the drug sweat, that sweat where you look like you have no life in you, with your, like, eyes, like, pushed in. It looks like you have the raccoon eyes. You could tell the guy had a rough night. And on top of that, he was being very aggressive. So she knew right off rip that she was not going to get in the car with him. So she definitely resisted. And so, yeah, so he tells her, get in the fucking car. The altercation began. Wade punched her. He hit her. He even ripped her dress right off of her in the parking lot in the middle of all the businesses. There were like some like 8 witnesses that saw the whole thing, and they're the ones that called authorities. So that was a fiasco on in itself. So anyways, Wade takes off And the Fort Myers police officer that testified in court, he said that he was part of the search for Wilson following the attack on Mila. And then he spotted him parked outside of a Joe's Crab Shack around 3 p.m. on October 7th of 2019. He went up to Wade and tells him that he is waiting for his girlfriend and was otherwise uncooperative, according to the police officer. Wade then rolled up the car window and drove off. The officer explained that he couldn't give chase when the suspect drove away because he was only wanted at that moment for a misdemeanor battery charge, which is basically following protocol not to chase the vehicle. At this point, when the police pulled him over or when the police spotted him in the parking lot, they didn't know about the murders yet. They were just responding to an assault and battery charge on Mila because of all of the people that watched him, you know, hit her and push her and all of that stuff. Meanwhile, now remember, Wade drove off. The cop had to let him go. He drove off. Meanwhile, a woman by the name of Diane Ruiz was walking on her way to her 10 a.m. bartending shift at the Moose Lodge in Cape Coral. This was earlier when he got pulled over. I didn't mention he was in Fort Myers. So when he took off on the cop, he drove, I think it was like 6 miles or something like that, and he ended up in Cape Coral. So Wilson spots this woman, Diane, and then he pretends that he needs directions. So he stops and he asks her for directions to a nearby school. And this is all in attempts to lure her into his car with absolutely no motive. Like, what was the reason for that? You know what I mean? Anyways, she did. I don't know how he got her in the car, but I'm assuming with his charm. And Wade Wilson decides to choke her. Like, right when she gets in the car, he reaches over to choke her. Diane tries to get out of the car, but Wade starts beating on her. And then, you know, he choked her. Then he pushes Diane out of the car, realizes she's alive, and then runs her over with the car at least 10 times while she was still alive. And then he drove off like nothing. I'll tell you what, that poor woman. I mean, both of them, you know, first of all, Christine sleeping wakes up being choked. That is scary in and of itself because you are your most vulnerable when you're sleeping, right? You're like not paying. You're not even in this realm when you're asleep, especially after a long night of partying. Once you hit that bed, you're gone, like dimension 10 at this point, cloud 9. And so imagine just being asleep and then waking up being strangled to death. Like, that's insane. And then this woman, Diane, just walking to work and then just, you know, being a kind human being, just giving directions. Let me tell you something. I have people like sometimes pull over to ask me for directions sometimes. And let me tell you, I'm very hesitant, and it's sad that we have to be like that these days, but it's the truth. Like, you got to be careful who you engage in conversation with, and don't you ever get into a stranger's car. Like, I don't understand how at this day and age, as adults, we don't, or not we, but like, I don't want to badmouth Diane Ruiz, obviously, rest in peace. Like, nobody deserves that. And she was being a kind person offering directions, but you should never have gotten in the car with this guy that you have no idea who he is. Like, I would have just given the guy directions and just kept on my merry way if I needed to be kind like that. You know what I mean? So I'm still trying to figure out what was it exactly that made her think it was okay to get into his car. And on top of that, if he really looked drugged out the way that Mila said he looked, like, doesn't that raise red flags? I don't have to know you to see your face and know that you're on something. But again, there are some people that are not privy to that, you know what I mean? So I don't want to judge or speculate on something that I have no idea about. So we're just going to leave it at that. But anyways, according to Diane's coworkers, they ended up calling the police because she didn't show up to work. And according to her coworkers, the woman never missed a shift in 5 years that she worked there. So obviously, her not showing up after saying she was showing up was 100% a red flag. So kudos to them for acting out and calling authorities like right then and there. So back to Wade Wilson's father. Steve said that Wade called him multiple times on that October 7th day and started describing what he'd done that day, calling himself a killer, saying that he did something that he cannot take back and that he did something to two people that will never be able to come back. So he admitted he didn't believe that his son was telling him the truth at first. And so he placed the call on speakerphone so that his wife can listen to the call as well. I'm not sure why he did that, putting the phone call on speaker. Maybe to see what his wife would think, if she would believe him and like tell him, hey, take this seriously or not. But I guess that's for Papa Steve to know or to answer if anybody wants to ask him. Anyways, Steve told the court that he asked Wade to tell him where he was at and that he'd send an Uber to pick him up. So after everything happened, I guess in desperation, Wade decided to call his father. But before he called his father, I believe he went to some guy's place of business, a guy that he had met a few times, and asked the guy to help him get out of the state. And he looked all like, you know, he looked all beat up, scratched up. He was shirtless. He looked angsty. And so the guy saw that this was sketch. And so according to the guy, he went out back, or he had a customer in there, told him to hold on, went out back. And then he ended up, I believe, calling authorities. But at this point, Wade took off. In an interview I heard with Steve, he did say that at first, when he actually believed his son, he wanted to help him. But then he realized who his son really is and told himself, if I don't do something, I turn him in, somebody else might get hurt. And that leads me to this next note that I have in front of me, because after all of that, he ends up showing up at a random house, breaks through the window, and gets into the house. What's crazy is that later we find out that the couple that owns that house or lives in that house had actually left early that morning out of town, which is crazy because I feel like they cheated death at that point. Because sometime, you know, later we get all these calls that we were listening to from Wade from 5 years ago. And Wade is telling his father in one of those video visits that they do in prison. And he tells his father, like, if there was anybody in that house, they were all going to be handled. Like, they were all going to die. And so that couple leaving that morning were so lucky that they weren't home when Wade did that. That is insane. Like, imagine being that couple and then getting a phone call with someone saying, we caught a murderer that broke into your house after murdering two women, and we just apprehended him in your home, and you're like 3,000 miles away. I would have a panic attack, honestly. That is crazy. I mean, this whole scenario is crazy, but that couple must be traumatized. Or maybe not traumatized because they weren't there, but like maybe they were just counting their blessings at this point that they're alive, you know? All right, so Wade gets arrested, and once he gets arrested, now we find out that he violated probation because before all of this took place, Wade had done some time in jail for all of the other crimes that I mentioned to you earlier. So he was out on probation and he was driving with a suspended license. So he violates probation and now he's in jail. No bond, nothing. He's in jail. They find Christine Melton's body. And then now I see this, and let me see if I have the notes here, but I looked it up, and the way that they say that they found Diane's body, I have it here somewhere. Here it is. It says that Diane's body was found 3 days later in a field behind a Sam's Club. And according to one of the officers who found her, he said that he found her because a single vulture was circling an area to the east side. And that's what led him to the right spot. That's crazy. Let me tell you something. My husband was a police officer for a good 8 years. Unfortunately, he's not a police officer anymore. He is wheelchair bound. He had a motorcycle accident, so he's no longer a police officer. But one thing that he used to always tell me was that police officers, they follow vultures a lot of the times, because the vultures, obviously, what do? They feed on, corpses, and they feed on roadkill. And so whenever you see vultures circling around, there's something dead nearby. So my husband always told me that whenever they saw vultures like that, they would do a quick check to make sure that it wasn't like a human body that the vultures were circling. So I'm not sure if this is correct about this officer finding the body, or if it was Wade that told the police where to find her. Because I saw, actually, it was this week or yesterday, I saw a phone call that was released on a YouTube channel called Phone Calls from Prison, where it's, mind you, these are phone calls from 2019 that are just being released now. And in this one phone call is a call between Wade and his dad. I should put the clip in here.
He's gone. Either he's gone and he's going to take off. And then I worried they were going to kill you. You were going to kill yourself. You were going to hurt these fucking people. And all of that was going to happen. No, I don't. You know, I just thought you'd do the right thing. And I knew, listen, I'm facing you. I don't. And I'm telling you I did it. I don't. Okay? And I know you're fucking going to be mad at me.
A little bit.
I know it. By the way, you got up.
I'm glad I didn't continue, though, to be honest with you, Dad.
No.
Yeah.
And I know what's in your heart.
I'm glad I didn't continue.
Wait, I know what's in your heart. And you know what? You have a shot right now. But goddammit, if you were to continue,
I promise you. Yeah.
They would have killed them. They killed you.
They would have killed me.
And go on. If they didn't kill you on the street, they were going to kill you in store.
Put me in the street. Yeah, I know. I don't believe it, sir. Yeah, I know.
So, goddammit.
I know.
I want to see you. I love you.
How long do you think you're going to give me a visit today? Right?
Yeah, for sure. Okay? I'm sorry. I'm going to be real with you, for sure. You're going to fall under the Prison for Reoffender Act, son.
Yeah.
And you've got two.
Yeah.
Okay?
All right.
And the other thing that's going to hurt you is the brutality of it.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, is it that bad with the first one, Jim?
No, the second one's terrible, though.
Now Wade's in prison, and the legal proceedings begin. Wade's mental health was presented, including testimony about his brain injuries. So he's claiming he had, you know, some brain illnesses, right? A neurologist testified that brain scans showed trauma and impairment, which might explain some of his impulsive behaviors. However, experts for the prosecution argued that drug abuse was a more significant factor in his actions. The defense claimed that Wilson's drug abuse could have impaired his judgment at the time of the crime. I believe that 100%. I have a cousin who I'm not going to name, but he is 6 years sober today, and it took him a really long time to realize, or honestly, it's not that he realized, it's what happened to him that made him change. And he's the type of person that he could take the smallest amount of any drug, and it's like a switch that goes on immediately, and a whole different persona pops out. It's like two different people when you see him sober and then when you see him on drugs. Like, when I tell you, it was so scary that I got a phone call from my daughter, who at the time was like 6 years old. I have a samurai sword that I inherited from my father when he passed away. And the sword was in my mother's house, and it was hanging up on the wall. And I get a phone call from my six-year-old daughter telling me, mind you, I'm down south. I live in Florida. I live in South Florida. this happened in Hialeah, Florida, where my mother lives. And I was living with my boyfriend at the time, who's my husband now, in Pinecrest. And my daughter was staying over my mom's house that night. And so I get a phone call from my daughter, and she tells me that my cousin is holding a really big knife and he's trying to hit my mom with it. At that point, my husband and I were like, what? We jump into my husband's unmarked unit and headed down up north with lights and sirens. All right. The next day, my cousin had no idea what had happened. My husband pulled up, literally knocked him out. There was no other way to handle it. My husband had to knock him out, drag him out of the house. I don't even know where my cousin ended up sleeping that night. But all I know is that he had no idea, no recollection at all as to what happened. And what had happened was that he grabbed the sword off the wall and he was trying to get money from my mom because he ran out of money to get drugs. My mom was saying no. And so this guy decides to threaten her. But this is what I'm saying. Like, you don't know, or the person doesn't know who or what they are when they're under the influence a lot of the times. So I do 100% on, like, I believe that. So anyways, Steve, Wilson's dad, or Wade's dad, he ended up testifying in court. He recounted his details of the confession that Wade gave him over the phone. Steve stated that his son ran over Diane Ruiz after realizing that she had not been dead. So he also could not explain, and he's talking about Wade, he could not explain the motive behind just wanting to do it. Now, after court deliberation, more than the required 8 out of the 12 jurors recommended the death penalty for Wilson. 9 jurors recommended the death penalty for the murder of Christine Melton, and 10 for the murder of Diane Ruiz. Having the power to take or disregard the jury's suggestion, Judge Nicholas Thompson imposed 2 death sentences. Obviously, Wade is appealing the decision with the Supreme Court of Florida now. So this whole case is sad, honestly. Do I think this could have been prevented? I'm not sure, because he seems, or Wade seems, like he would have done whatever the fuck he wanted to do, whether or not Mila or anybody was going to try to stop him. So I'm not sure if it could have been prevented per se, but I will tell you what I think could have been prevented. Diane Ruiz's murder. I feel like that could have been prevented, because at this point, there's nobody in the house with him and Christine. You know, that's something that nobody is ever going to know. Only Wade, because Christine is not here. Had the cop stopped him and arrested him for trying to take off, then Diane would not have been found and then murdered. So do I blame the cop? No, but I will say this. I mean, the cop was just following protocol, but what I will say is my husband, having been in a police officer for 8+ years, which I've been trying to tell him to get on this podcast with me. So if you can tell me or him in the comments to please get on the podcast, that would be helpful, because he needs to get on here. And it's not just him. I heard it off of Duty Ron as well. He's a retired NYPD detective, and he was a first responder for 9/11. He also said the same thing that my husband said, which is, had he had been the one to pull over Wade at that parking lot, he would have A, blocked him better, and upon initial, like, pulling him over, he shouldn't have let him stay in the car like that. He should have told him to get outside of the car and turn off the car and whatnot, but instead he just stood there. He could have handled it a little bit differently without disobeying, you know, his law, or without abusing the protocol. But he could have handled it a little bit differently without abusing the protocol. But obviously that's hearsay now, because it's too late. So anyway, that is what happened there, which honestly, it didn't even work out for Wade, because he ended up getting the 2 death sentences. Everything else got thrown out, which that's normal when you get a death sentence, because at that point, it's like, what's the point? I'm going to give you 25 years and a death sentence. I mean, you're already not going to see the light of day ever again in your life. So what's the point of even charging you with theft and all of this other crap that is irrelevant at this point? So he is now serving time. He got his sentence last month. No, last month was September. So he got sentenced August 27th. And since he's been entertaining us with his phone calls, I tell you, I really did not want to do this case, but it just gets more interesting every day. It's been 5 years since the murders, and the guy has gone viral multiple times. His phone calls are literally a soap opera. It's like a whole series on YouTube. You are more than welcome to just type Wade Steven Wilson phone calls on YouTube and just have at it. Let me tell you, there are so many girls. See, this is where I want to get to on another episode, because I'm not going to have the time on this one. But I definitely want to get into a conversation where we talk about the women in this case, or in his life, rather. Because, listen, you have likely heard of infamous cases where criminals, particularly violent men, they garner a fan base of sorts. But what I want to know is, what is it that drives this fascination? What compels someone to fall for a criminal? Right? And more so like a woman beater, a rapist, a murderer. And so I'm like so confused, because after all of this happened with the confessions, because I didn't say that here, but Wade confessed so many times, I've lost count. He confessed in the interrogation room when he was interrogated, over a promise of bringing him McDonald's and a McFlurry, which he never got, by the way. He ended up confessing to everything. He confessed to his father on the phone, knowing, hello, when you're making a phone call from prison, the first thing you hear is, calls will be recorded. So if you know the calls are being recorded and you're still talking, don't come crying a river later asking why. You're being recorded. And so he confessed to his dad on the phone. He got Mila on the phone, and he confessed to Mila. Mind you, I think if I'm not mistaken, the only reason Mila even answered that jail call, because they did have a stay away order from the battery and stuff that he did onto her, and he was locked up for 3 months because of being abusive with her. So he wasn't really allowed to call her, but he did. And I think the reason why she answered was because she had reporters or somebody was there with her. So she wanted to get information out of him. Because if you listen to that phone call, she's literally asking him, what happened? I need to know. I need to know what happened. And so he then described it. And the way that he described it was like so freaking cold-hearted. Like he was like, no, I choked her out. I choked the bitch. I choked her out. I ran over the other girl. He even told his dad that he ran over Diane so many times that he made her look like spaghetti. So that just shows you where the guy's head is at. And this is him sober talking. So this is why, like, okay, 100% the drugs will have an effect on who you are. And I'm pretty sure that they played a role that night. But can we say that that was entirely what caused everything to click with him? No, because he's had a history of being abusive towards women. He's had a history of beating women. He had a girlfriend named Kelly, who you can find her on TikTok too. Kelly was a girl that he dated. Don't know exactly what happened. I haven't really looked much into her, but I do know the story. And he tied her up. He stripped her clothes off. He either threw her in the back seat or threw her in the trunk of her own car, drove down to Marathon, Florida, which is basically the Keys, and left her stranded over there. And then she apparently called the police after. They did nothing. So I think now she's suing the police department that they called because they didn't do anything about it. But I mean, the guy has a history of being violent and going to jail and all of these things. So, you know, Yeah, the drugs probably amplified what he already, the monster that he had inside of him, and probably like woke him up. And this is the day that it finally clicked, that he finally just snapped, you know? Definitely. But you can't deny the person that he is truly on the inside. And he had a rough kind of early upbringing, but not really, because he was adopted when he was a baby, so he can't even remember, you know, not being loved or anything like that, because the people who adopted him, they raised him well, they took care of him, they loved him, gave him a good home. So I don't think he lacked love, you know. And then later on in his life, he actually, you know, reunited with his biological parents. So, I mean, it couldn't have been that bad, you know? So I can't blame that. It's not like Krista Pike, right? Or the last episode, where Krista Pike had this atrocious life. Like, you were kind of expecting her to do something fucked up. You know what I mean? Because the type of trauma. And on top of that, because of the trauma from her parents or her mother, the girl had frontal lobe damage from that. So we're not dealing with that here. This is why I tell you, like, people snap, you know? You just never know. But to say again, to say that he was affected because of his early childhood, not after all the other shit I've heard from these other people, like I said, like Krista Pike and stuff. Like, you can't, you know, and I know that everybody deals with trauma differently, and some people may handle something like nothing, and to somebody else, it's the end of the world. I totally get that, but I can't, not with this. You can't tell me that, you know, that it was your upbringing, which I don't think he did, but, you know, I'm just throwing it out there. Since we did talk about him being adopted and all of that. So anyways, that is all that I have for today's episode. I wanted to touch on the history. I wanted to touch on the actual crimes. I wanted to touch on, you know, his previous crimes, a little bit of everything leading up to the sentencing. And I have someone who I wanted to bring on today to talk about the original topic that this episode was going to be about, which is basically the psychology behind the infatuation that these women have with this guy. Because if you know anything about this case, then you 100% know about the fan base that has completely blown up on TikTok with this guy. Fan pages. Now there's merch. And the merch, he's coming up with this merch from jail. The GoFundMe pages that have reached, last time I checked, $80,000 of women, all women donating to him. There are women that have tattooed his name on them, his face on them. I mean, there are women flying from Germany to come see him. The phone sex. There is so much to unpack here that I just said, you know what? We're gonna make this a series. Part two will come next week, hopefully. And we're gonna get into the wives and the women, because, like I said, I have questions. So yeah, that is all that I have for you guys today. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode. If this is multiple episodes that you've listened to, you are the real MVP. I really appreciate it. Please like, subscribe, follow whatever platform you're on. Leave a comment, engage. That is what pushes our content out to listeners, and it helps us grow our platforms. And I really do appreciate each and every one of you. With that being said, remember, the past is never truly behind us. It echoes in the stories that we tell and the lessons that we learn. Until next time.